Good afternoon, everyone. This is May 17th. I'd like to convene the Education Finance Omnibus Conference Committee, E12 Education Conference Committee, to bring it to order. Today, we want to look at issues related to stability of educational opportunities for students in the state. I thought we'd start, however, on a positive note. And there is, I feel like I'm back in the classroom. If you'd take one and pass it along. A remarkable story about what happens when we provide Minnesota students varied pathways to post-secondary opportunities and to their hopes and dreams there. It's the story in today's Star Tribune of, I'm going to go slowly here, Melinda Cassandra Lopez from Truman, Minnesota, who's 18 years old, and in about 3 weeks, she's going to graduate from high school. But before that, she's going to graduate from community college with a two-year RN degree. And she's been taking advantage of the PSEO opportunities that the state allows. She's clearly a very driven young woman, as if you go into the story, so are her younger siblings who have similar dreams. Her goals are to sit the boards for the RN degree and pass those, and then move on to a program to become an advanced practice RN, and then to go to medical school to become a physician, and specifically, and her focus to me is amazing, to become a pediatric gynecological surgeon. This girl is 18 years old, and she figures she'll have all of that done by the age of 25, which, you know, makes me feel like, what have I been doing the last number of years of my life? But it does go to the stress that the House placed on varied bridges to post-secondary and what can happen when we do that, and maybe to add another layer onto it, she and her younger siblings all have goals of working in the medical field in the Truman area. So when we provide students opportunities in their own communities, they're more likely to stay or return to their own communities. So I just thought it was a remarkable story worth lifting up here today. I don't know if you'd seen that, Madam Chair.
I did see this article. Very exciting, and you use the term bridges, and that's what we look for, mm-hmm. is bridges. This is a bridge to nursing degree. I have visited Minnesota West. They do a great job. We also have in other places, we have other bridges as well. One I think I mentioned in the committee a few days ago, the bridges to healthcare. Which also allows students to graduate with their diploma and either those designations needed for pharmacy tech, CNA, and a couple others. Then we have CTech that does something similar with vet tech. So I think our schools and our community colleges have done a nice job in responding to the need and the partnerships that they're making, those partnerships. And of course, as you know, we talk about adding CTech to that wealth of opportunities for our kids as well, that provides that overarching bridging those silos of K-12 and higher ed that we've so often spoken of. So I think this is exciting, and Melinda is a great great example of being focused and taking advantage of opportunities. I expect we'll hear many more great things about her.
I imagine we will. So now we want to transition to issues regarding opportunities for students in our E-12 system and making sure that there's stable opportunities available to them. I often discuss this as a matter of when the child leaves school this spring, What level of assurance do they have that that same staff that they have relationships with, those same programs that they benefit from, will be there again in the fall? So we wanted to focus today on special education in Minnesota and the crisis level that our school districts are experiencing in terms of state support and state funding for the special education services that they provide to students. They are providing those services. They, of course, would and, of course, do, and we fund those services insufficiently, and that's what has become a crisis. There's a very good Star Tribune story from yesterday that walks through a number of examples of different dimensions of the problem. White Bear Lake, Minneapolis, and is Truman pop up in here again? Rockford, where I believe Ms. Palmer lives, the Rockford District, as different aspects to the challenges that school districts are facing because of the underfunding of special education services. Dr. Melcher has been good enough to pull together a presentation for us, and Dr. Melcher, if you could please come forward. And in addition, members have received two runs that we will get to, but let's start with the PowerPoint presentation. Dr. Melcher, welcome to the committee today. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. This PowerPoint presentation is somewhat similar to a presentation I made in the Senate Policy Committee in August and again in the House in January, and there have been some things added to it since then. So this is dealing with special education and English learner funding trends, and it has a little bit about the governor's and the House budget proposals in those areas. So the first slide is showing you the trend in special education enrollment from birth to 21, going back to 2003. We have seen an increase from about 116,000 special education students in our state to about 147,000 in this current year.
And Mr. Chair, would you like questions at the end of the presentation or along the way?
Dr. Melcher, what's your preference?
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer questions as we go.
Senator Nelson, do you have a question?
Oh, just a very brief one. Can you just give us an idea, as we look at these increasing numbers in special ed costs, it would be helpful for us to know, too, what percent of our students are over since 2003, we've seen, I think, perhaps some declines in enrollment. I think we're in the uptick again. But it'd just be helpful to know, in general, are we seeing a greater percent of our students in special education? I think that's the wisdom I've heard, but would just like to see the numbers or have you confirm that.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, that's the very next slide.
He did not pay me to set that up.
Okay. Representative Rudolph, you had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, this goes starting in 2003. Was there a particular date where special education was designated? I mean, I can remember back in prehistoric times when, there'd be a couple of slow kids in the school that went off to a room to get some additional help. Obviously, things have changed tremendously since then, but is there a date when this all started?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, this goes back many, many years. The federal mandate goes back to the mid-1970s. I believe Minnesota and Wisconsin were two of the states that were ahead of the federal mandate, so we were providing a significant amount of special education services before that time, but certainly there has been a continual growth over the past three or four decades.
All right. Representative Rudolph.
Just to say then that back in the 50s and 60s, that would kind of been pre this time. So the 70s is a date that we could kind of hang our thinking on.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rudolph, yes, that's when the federal mandate was started. But again, Wisconsin and Minnesota were doing quite a bit before that. So we've been doing special education in Minnesota for more than 50 years.
Dr. Melcher, to the next slide, perhaps. I'll let you pace us.
Well, just one slight other comment I wanted to make is that our school districts are responsible to provide special education services for students in non-public schools as well as public schools. And so you can see the we've got about 2,000 non-public schools at the bottom of the chart, and most of the students are, of course, in the public school districts. The non-public part has been very stable over the years. The public school part has been growing. So to Senator Nelson's question, the next slide is showing you the percentage of the public school students who are in special education. It's grown from 13.4% in 2003 up to 15% in 2011. It was stable for a few years, but since 2015, we've seen again an increase from 15% up to 16.3%. So we do have a growing percentage of our students receiving special education services.
Dr. Melcher, let me ask a variation then on Representative Erdahl's question. Did something change in 2015 to account for this uptick? Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not a special education program expert. I'm more of a number cruncher. But I would say I don't think there was any significant change in laws or legislation. I think we've just seen a continued growth in the number of students that have been identified as needing these services. I think a slide or two down the road, I'm showing you which of the primary disability areas are seeing the largest amount of growth over the last few years. So that might show you some of the change. But I don't believe there's been any significant change in law that would cause this growth.
All right. Thank you. Senator Nelson, is that a signal?
Just a brief comment. I think it might be coming in the rest of the presentation. But I do remember when Public Law 94-142 passed, 1975. And that was the year of I graduated from high school, but was also then in college and was starting my degree in special education at that time. But maybe since we have Dr. Melcher here, this is just a little bit of a rabbit trail, but Representative Erdahl kind of mentioned it a little bit. Could you just briefly talk a little bit, because we know that we had special ed before 94-142. My mom was a special education teacher, well before 1975. And so maybe just for a good piece of history, so when Public Law 94-142 passed in 1975, how did that change? What did that do to change the trajectory or how we look at special ed today?
Dr. Melcher, from a number crunching
chair, Senator Nelson, I haven't looked back at the statistics going back quite that far recently, but I believe that the primary impact was in other states that were not providing special education at the time, but also just the mandate there, I believe, led to an uptick in the number of students that were identified because school districts were now required to provide this service. I know I have a little background in special education as well. My dad was the special ed director for the state of Wisconsin in the 50s and 60s, so I remember very well traveling around the state with him as he was working on getting school districts to start their special education programs, and at the time it was more voluntary. So we know it's gone on for a long time, but certainly there was a significant increase at the time, 94-142.
Thank you. Just one final
Senator
question.
Nelson.
Thank you. And Dr. Melcher, so was it in 1975 that we received the promise that the feds would pay for 40% of special education? I don't think they ever have, but I'm assuming that's when that promise originated.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, yes, that's when that originated.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
So we've had this growth in our number of special education students. This pie chart is just showing you a kind of a brief overview of where we sit in 2019 with the largest categories of primary disability being specific learning disabilities, autism spectrum disorders, developmentally delayed. And one thing I will say with developmentally delayed is that's our preschool population, and we have seen a lot of growth in that area, I think in part because of the increase in the amount of activity with students that are receiving pre-K educational services, scholarships, and so forth, that there's more of a opportunity for students to be identified early, and that has contributed to some of the growth, but certainly not all of the growth in special education. Moving on to the next slide, Mr. Chair and members, this is showing the categories of special education that have seen the largest growth in the last 6 years. Autism spectrum disorders is the largest, growing from about 16,000 to about 20,000 students, where that is the primary disability, followed by developmentally delayed, which is the early childhood part we talked about, then specific learning disability, other health disabilities, and emotional behavioral disabilities are all categories that have seen significant increases that account for that increase that we've seen in the past few years. When we look at the breakdown of special education costs, what's driving special education costs? So you have more students receiving services. Some of those are services that are in fairly expensive categories. But most of the cost for special education is personnel. So about 61% is salaries, 20% fringe benefits. So we're talking 81% staffing costs. And then also our special education funding formula covers special education transportation. For students that have special transportation needs is about 10%. We also provide other transportation, about 2%. That includes non-special education students that have special transportation needs. So that would include, for example, homeless students who are transported back to their school of origin, or students in care and treatment programs. It's basically transportation that's similar to special education transportation because it's very unique and higher cost. And then all of the other costs for special education are relatively small in terms of making up the pie. Another way of slicing the pie for special education costs and to see how it's growing is looking at this chart. You'll see that the large numbers at the bottom are the special education program costs. That's the teachers, paraprofessionals, other staff for special education programs. The little blue wedge you see there is what we call the ADSIS program, alternative delivery of specialized instructional services for kids that are kind of in that pre-K, early elementary area, where we are looking at students who might eventually be in special education but need some additional services now that may avoid the need for them to go into special education. You can see that's a fairly rapidly growing part of our system, but still pretty small, $59 million of expenditures in 2018 compared to $12 million in 2012. So, again, percentage-wise, a huge increase, but in terms of total dollars, still not that big.
Dr. Melcher, if you could pause for a moment. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, with the ADSIS program, is a lot of that, like you just said, there's areas where we might be able to do a little preventative stuff so kids yes. don't. Is that why we're seeing they're growing as we're beginning to understand all the needs at the early levels of the preventative stuff so that they don't end up being in special education, or we can actually have them more mainstream than we might have been able to do if we wouldn't have caught it early?
Dr. Miller, Mr. Chair and Representative Youakim, yes, that's exactly what this is about, and I think the program is relatively new. I believe it started in fiscal year 2007, so you see nothing there in fiscal 06, and we have more and more districts that are participating. There is an application process districts go through with the Department of Education. There are barriers, of course, when you add programs like this. It does cost you money. I think there's hope that in the long term there will be some savings, but in the short term it does cost money. Because our special ed funding is based on prior year data, districts are covering the whole cost in the first year, and then they hope to get roughly a 60% reimbursement after that, as they do on the other parts of the special ed formula. So it's gradually increasing.
Dr. Melcher, can you provide any examples of what these services are? We talk about them, and we never define them or give examples.
Mr. Chair, I'm a numbers cruncher rather than a program expert. I believe this would go into, for example, some assistance with reading area. Students that are they're just kind of falling behind, that need a little extra support to keep up with their peers. But they haven't been identified as having a specific special education disability. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure if there are other people that are more expert in the program area than I am, but I'm looking at it primarily from the numbers perspective.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the next slide is showing you the trend since 2003 on the federal aid. That's the green at the bottom. On the state aid, which is the kind of gold color in the middle, and then the cross-subsidy is the blue on the top of the slide. And as you can see, basically the federal aid has been flat, except for a couple of years around 2010, 2011, when we had an influx under the ARRA Recovery Act programs. And the state aid has continued to grow fairly quickly. And the cross-subsidy is kind of inching up. It's continuing to grow. So in the current year, 2019, we have about $714 million of cross-subsidy out of the total of about $2.5 billion of special education expenditures.
Dr. Melcher, can you do those numbers again real quickly for me?
So total special education expenditures, $2.5 billion, of which $714 million is the cross-subsidy, $1.6 billion is state aid, and $180 million is federal special ed aid. And as you can see, we're projecting that the cross-subsidy will continue to grow under current law, despite continued increases in state aid. So we're projecting it will be growing to $794 million in 2021 and to $879 million by 2023 under current law.
Representative Youakim.
Dr. Melcher. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, for the, you said state aid's growing. Is that mostly due to the increased number of students and how it works with the formula, or are we actually making increased investments?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Youakim, I would say that a lot of it is due to more students, and a lot of it is due to inflationary costs. It's mostly teacher salaries and transportation costs, and those do grow as teachers go up the salary schedule, and also as there are salary settlements due to inflation, so there are higher costs there. And then we have, I think, probably a little bit greater concentration of students with very expensive kinds of needs, and so we're seeing some additional services that go beyond. So the average cost per special education student adjusted for inflation is growing as well, which would suggest to me that we are seeing some additional services provided in order to meet the needs of those students under their IEPs.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Youakim.
So, Dr. Melcher, it's not because we're adding more money in because they need it. It's basically it's the market forces are pushing that up.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions, Dr. Melcher. Those total numbers that you spoke of, $2.5 billion in total special ed costs, could you just run through those numbers one more time?
Yes,
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair. So the exact numbers off of the slide is $2,483,000,000 in total expenditure, $714 million in the cross-subsidy, $1,585,000,000 in state special ed aid, and $185 million in federal special ed aid.
Thank you, thank you. And then,
Senator Nelson.
Speaking of the on the aid side and the costs, could you refresh my memory? I believe our special education formulas do have one of the few in education that we do have an automatic inflator. And if you could describe momentarily what that automatic inflator is, and if you know how much increase that brought to the special education formula in the budget forecast.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the special education formula is primarily a cost reimbursement formula. It's a little bit complicated because it has one formula based on total special ed cost, including fringe benefits, another formula based on the old way we did it was without fringe benefits, and then a third is a pupil-driven formula. The pupil-driven formula includes a 4.6% annual inflation factor, which is the same inflation factor we used for many years as part of the old special education formula before that. The other two do not have an automatic inflation factor, but they grow every year based on what the cost is in the actual salaries and other expenses for transportation. So the average rate of growth has been in the neighborhood of 5% a year.
And then
Senator Nelson.
And then when we're looking at the numbers that you have before us, that includes all three of those factors. It includes the inflationary factor as well as the cost reimbursement, the two cost reimbursement formulas as well.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melcher.
Yes.
Thank you.
And to put this in perspective a little bit, also part of the growth in cost in the state special ed formula is kind of a declining share of federal special education funding. So the federal special education funding has been quite flat over the years, but on this particular slide I'm showing the percentage of funding made up by federal, state, and sources. And so what you can see here is that we had a spike up to about 16%, you know, still well short of the 40% in 2010 and 2011 when the federal government doubled the amount of aid for a couple of years under ARRA. And then it's gone down to 8.5% in 2015, 7.5% this year, and we're projecting 6.1% by 2023. So what's basically happening here is special ed costs are growing, the federal funding is flat. So there's a cost shifting going on here. A district can no longer afford to have all of the staff on federal funding that they used to have on federal funding. So part of the increase in state aid is the fact that we are transferring some staff from federal funding to state funding in order to cover the hole that's created because the federal government is not inflating the amount of aid. So what you can see here is that there has been a significant increase in the percentage of costs covered by the state. Part of that is to offset the reduction in the federal aid, but still we're seeing a little bit of an increase from 68.4% in 2015 up to 71% in the current year, and we're projecting 71.8% by 2023 under current law. So the state certainly is maintaining its share, but what happens when the state is funding roughly 70% of a growing cost, the cross-subsidy grows too because the districts are picking up the other 30% of that cost increase every year.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to your response to Chair Joachim's question, and I understand greater numbers, I understand inflationary costs, but you did also indicate additional services, and so additional services would be represented by new dollars that have to be spent for those purposes. Would that be correct, Mr. Melcher?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, that is correct.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Nelson, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and just to follow up, Dr. Melcher. So we've talked about how we're serving more students, more different categories, and the costs have increased partly because we now include the newer formula, which includes staff costs and benefit costs. But what I was wondering is, we're comparing. You know, it's always easy for us to point to the feds and say, you know, the feds are really driving this. They're not keeping their promise, which we can see is the actual case here. But I did want to drill down on that just a little bit. And if we're looking at the percent of our special education funding that the feds are taking care of now, which is not mm-hmm. anywhere near their 40% promise.
Right.
But my question is, if our costs are continuing to go up for the reasons that we just spoke of, could it be that the federal special ed payments are going up, but they're just not going up as quickly as our costs are, and so therefore the percent of those federal payments would be lower, but perhaps the actual amount of those federal payments has increased?
Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, if I go back to the previous slide, we showed the actual dollar amounts not adjusted for inflation here. And you can see there was a little bit of increase between 2013. We were at $174 million of federal aid. We went to $180 million in 2017, $185 million in 2019, $191 million in 2021. So there has been a little bit of federal increase, but it's been very slow and less than the rate of inflation.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair and members, this next slide is just taking a look at a similar sort of thing, but what this one is doing is looking at inflation-adjusted cost based on the CPI, and we are looking at the red dotted line at the bottom is the cross-subsidy per student, the green line is the state aid, and the blue line is the inflation-adjusted special ed total cost per student. So what you can see here in the red line is that the cross-subsidy has been fairly stable since 2015. We were at $821 per student on the average, and now we're at $820 per student on the average. And part of that was the change to the new special education funding formula that was enacted in 2013. There was a $40 million increase in that year, which took effect in 2016. So we kind of, with the change that was made in 2013, effective in 2016, we kind of, on an inflation-adjusted basis, kind of kept that cross-subsidy constant. But what we're seeing is, under current law, if we look to the next 2 years, what we're seeing is a projected increase to $861 per student in 2021 and to $901 per student by 2023. So as we look out to the future, we're projecting to see an increase in the cross-subsidy per student when we adjust for inflation.
And one more.
Thank you. Senator Nelson?
This might be an elementary question, but I do want to. So when we talk about cost per student, are you talking about, as we look at a cross-subsidy, that goes across all the students in the district? And I just want some clarity. I'm assuming that is the cross-subsidy cost per student in the entire district, not just the increased cost of special ed per student.
Madam Chair, that Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, yes, these are dollars per average daily membership. So total students in the district.
Thank you.
So one thing we know is that the cross subsidy is averages $820 per student, but it's not the same in every district. It varies quite a bit. This chart is showing you a breakdown for 2013, 2015, and 2017 on the size of the cross-subsidy by type of district. And we have variations within types of district as well. We have some small rural districts with very high cross-subsidies, some small rural districts with very low cross-subsidies. But there are some trends that we see. And one of the trends is that the cross-subsidy in the Minneapolis and St. Paul district is quite a bit higher than it is anywhere else. So averaging about $1,400 per student, for every student in the district. In those districts, metropolitan suburban districts tend to be averaging about $1,000 per student. In the inner ring suburbs, those that have a common boundary with Minneapolis and St. Paul, and averaging about $900 per student in outer ring suburbs. Then we see the larger non-metro, those that have more than 2,000 students, and we can see they're getting up. They've seen a lot of growth in their cross subsidy, and they are getting up very close to what the suburban districts are. So this would include districts like St. Cloud, Rochester, Duluth, Mankato. But again, there are quite a bit of variation within that group as well. And then we have the smaller, the medium-sized non-metro, and the smaller non-metro. And you can see that as you get smaller, the cross subsidy gets a little bit lower on the average. And I think that's in part due to families that have students with disabilities tending to locate in communities that have full-service special education programs. And so you have kind of a natural movement. If you've had people coming in from St. Cloud, that there is an example, they'll say, we've got a lot of students that come in to St. Cloud area and settle there because their child has a disability, and they know we provide good services. So that's very common. And then what you see for charter schools, they have a relatively small cross subsidy because, of course, they're able to bill back 90% of the unfunded cost to the resident school district, or 100% if they have more than 70% special education. So that's kind of the difference as it breaks down among regions or types of districts, but certainly there's a lot of variation within regions that shouldn't be overlooked.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm really new to this area, so I'm just trying to get my head around it. And I was interested in that last comment about charter schools and the relationship with the district. So the charter school can build the district for, it sounded like 90% or somewhere between 70 and 90% of the cost. But the district cannot similarly bill the state. I guess that's the whole point of the cross-subsidy. Am I understanding that right?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pinto, yes, that's correct. The Minnesota law for a long time has made the resident school district responsible for special education costs, for unfunded special education costs. So if a student open enrolls to another school district or open enrolls to a charter school, historically the resident district paid 100% of the unfunded costs. The student, the charter school or the other school district serving the student pays the teachers, collects the aid, which covers roughly 60 to 70% of the cost, and then they bill the resident district for the unfunded portion of the cost. We do have a provision in state law that says that a charter school has more than 70% of their students in special education. So a good example would be Metro Deaf, 100% special ed students. They're able to bill 100% of their unfunded cost back to the resident district, because obviously if all of your students are special ed, you can't cross-subsidize the other students to cover the whole. So that's the only way a district school like Metro Deaf can stay in business, would be to bill 100% of that cost back to the resident district.
Dr. Melcher, how is that 70% number arrived at to trigger the 100% tuition bill back?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall the origin of that. Mr. Strom may have a better memory of that than I do, but it was a legislative policy decision to decide if your charter school has a very large concentration of special ed students, the higher your concentration, the more difficult it will be to cross-subsidize the balance with the remaining other 30% of the students. So I think it was just a policy decision. You could have done it at 60%. You could have done it at 80%. The legislature settled on 70.
Okay. All right. Members, you've received to this point a two charts, actually, that walk us through two scenarios. One, the below 70% special education school district, or excuse me, charter school. And this, Dr. Melcher, the same math applies to tuition billing between districts for students who open and enroll out of their resident district. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. That's
thank right. you. So what happens, as I'm best able to explain it, is the first bar on the left is the special education student at the charter school, in this case is the scenario, draws down the state and federal aid that's available to them based on their various status as a student and as one who requires special education services. And then, as Dr. Melcher just explained, that leaves 30% of that cost remaining. And of, do I have that right? The remaining amount that the district, 90% of the remaining special education costs, not 90% is in this case identified as $3,600. So almost $13,000 in expenses in that first bar. 90% of the special education costs is $3,600. The charter school is able to bill back 90% of that to the school district, which leaves the charter school with, of the total special education costs, $400. Remaining of their expenses, while the resident district is billed for $3,600. So it's a small amount left on for the charter school to pick up. It's a significant portion for the resident district to pick up. And of course, multiplication comes into play here as districts look at numbers of students who are choosing to open enroll into other districts or to go to charter schools. And many districts have seen an increase in these in the tuition billing in the last few years. There's been, I think, some significant movement in the amount of tuition being billed back. Dr. Melcher, am I correct on that last part?
Mr. Chair, yes, the tuition billing continues to grow. Each year, basically, it's based on what the unfunded cost is of special education, and we have seen some increase in the percentage of our students who are in charter schools, including the percentage of special education students in charter schools. They've had a lot more growth in their special ed programs than school districts, and so you're seeing an increase in the tuition bills for that. Yes.
And I know Duluth, I don't know if you heard any of the bills, the number of bills, actually, out of the Duluth School District and from members there, because of some of the sharp spike that they've seen in the tuition billing area. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we have spoken of the, and we have heard those bills regarding the tuition bill back, and I think we've mentioned it in this conference committee mm-hmm. before as well, and it is a significant issue. And without a real clear solution, on the one hand, of course, I would understand as a parent, I would want to make sure that my child with who might have special needs was able to go to that charter school or that neighboring resident district mm-hmm. that provided the full gamut of special education services and then some. And so I definitely understand the parent's perspective, but I also clearly understand the incentive to spend more, even on good things, mm-hmm. when you're only responsible to pay for 10% of it. So there's a real dilemma here in how this particular bill back system works, and I have yet to see exactly I think what is a a perfect solution, but I'm hoping we can be moving in the right direction to right the ship a bit.
I think, Madam Chair, if you're expecting the Minnesota legislature to come up with a perfect solution for anything, you will be sorely disappointed. But I also think what this chart illustrates is the charter school or the non-resident district isn't responsible for 10%. It's more like 4% mm-hmm. that they're responsible for. I won't say insignificant, but it's a small percentage of the expense that is they currently bear, while the non-resident or the resident district bears more. And it strikes me, and I know I'm not going to get the terminology right here, but there's something about the commons where you make an individual choice, and I make an individual choice. You choose to send your child to a charter school or a neighboring school district where you believe they will have received better services, and we all affirm your parenting choice to do that. As an individual, we affirm that. When it becomes collective, when we see numbers of parents making that same decision, the cost then falls back on all of the students, including the special education students, in the resident district.
That is the inequity.
Yeah. So the potentially right, hopefully right decision for your child ends up stressing the school district that you live in and their ability to provide services to all of their students, including your neighbors.
Yes, that is, as I said, there is an mm-hmm. inequity in how that formula is working right now.
And then if you flip over to scenario two, this would be a scenario with a charter school that has over 70% special education students where they are able to bill back 100% of their costs. So there you see a student receiving $32,000 in special education services, and the charter school also spends $23,000 in general education costs. So you're looking at, quick math, $55,000. In expense for a student not in their resident school district programming being paid for by the resident school district. And that's significant.
Yes.
Questions from members? Dr. Melcher, do you want to walk through? I'm seeing it as slide 12. Is that
yes,
where you want to go next?
Mr. Chair, yes. So with your permission, I would like to – this gets into the funding.
Let me pause you for a moment.
Otherwise, I was done with the special ed part. I have some background slides on EL as well.
Okay. Why don't we pause for a moment, members? I failed to look down when I should have. Madam Chair, we carry provisions in the House bill that – works towards this inequity, as you've described it, with the tuition bill back, and takes it to two different levels, 80% and then 70%. So taking a slight change in the percentage of special education costs that charter schools and non-resident schools, open enrollment recipients, are able to bill back to the resident school districts. And I just wanted to draw members' attention to the two runs we have. In the upper right-hand corner, they're identified as 3/26/2019 and 3/27/2019. And the 3/26 looks at a tuition bill back rate, changing that from the current 90% to 70%, and the March 27th run looks at changing that tuition go back rate just to 80%. And this gives members a chance to see how those changes might play out in their school districts or school districts in their area. So before we moved on, I wanted to draw members' attention to those. All right. Dr. Melcher, we have about 10 minutes.
Okay.
The Senate is going into is going to convene at 3:15, and members asked for 15 minutes to scoot themselves across the street and prepare for that.
But Mr. Chair, I think the next couple of slides provide a little background that will help members read these printouts a little easier. If I could go.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So this is looking at both the governor's proposal and the House proposal. They're similar, but the House has more dollars in their proposal. So some of the goals were to provide sufficient funding to keep the special ed cross subsidy per student from growing. And in the governor's bill, that's literally what the governor's recommendation did. It was basically providing enough dollars in the special education aid formula to keep the cross subsidy per pupil at $820 on average, rather than having it grow to $861 by the end of the biennium. And the House proposal put more funding into that, and what they did is actually buy down the cross subsidy from $820 to about $810. So that's essentially the difference. The governor's proposal was about $60.9 million, and the House proposal was about $117.8 mm-hmm. Million. Dollars. So that was the kind of one of the leading issues here, was that in order to provide adequate funding or more adequate funding for special education, but also to when you're providing an increase in the general ed formula, to have that not be spent on covering a bigger cross subsidy for special ed. Part of that, I think, the interest was in keeping the special ed cross subsidy from growing. And the second, I think, issue was to improve fairness by using more up-to-date data and eliminating the cap, which we know has caused problems for a number of districts. And then to the mechanics of how the House and the governor did that, the principal vehicle here was cross subsidy reduction aid as a new component of special education formula. Pretty straightforward, just saying after we get done with all of the calculations, how big is the cross subsidy per kid per ADM in your district? If you have a cross subsidy that's higher than another district, you get more cross subsidy. So in the governor's plan, the cross subsidy aid was 2.6% of the cross subsidy the first year, growing to 6.4% the second year. And in the House plan, it was 4.3% of the cross subsidy the first year, growing to 8.6%. So if one district has a cross subsidy that's twice as big as another district, they'd get twice as much cross subsidy aid. It would be the last step in the calculation, basically reducing that cross subsidy proportionally for every district in the state. The second thing that both the governor and the House did in their proposal was to update the student-driven portion of the formula. We talked about how there are three formulas. We're currently using the formula based on 2011 data that was part of that 2013 legislation. There's a requirement for the department to do a study annually and provide you with information on what the impact would be if we updated it. So this would use 2018 data. It's not as big a difference as it sounds, because we take the 2011 data, and as I said earlier, we're updating that by 4.6% each year. So on average, it's pretty similar, but what we see is over 7 years, there are changes. Some special ed disability areas grow faster in their costs than others. So this is using more up-to-date data that more clearly reflects what the current year situation is in districts. The third proposal was to eliminate the special education aid cap. We know that that's created some inequities for some districts. It's based on frozen 2016 data. Some districts have had growing costs for special ed beyond their control since 2016. By eliminating the cap, you eliminate some of those inequities. Then adjusting the hold harmless by reducing the reliance on that frozen 2016 data and using newer data is basically beginning to phase out that hold harmless a little bit, and it avoids some windfalls that we've seen creep in, where some school districts have actually had a reduction in their special ed costs since 2016, but yet the formula is growing at 4.6% a year. So they're in some cases getting 70, 80, 90% of their cost covered, when other districts are at 60%. So this is a way of reducing inequities and basically reducing some of the cost to the state for districts that are receiving a windfall, and using it to help pay for eliminating the cap on districts that really have these unmet needs.
Dr. Melcher, if I can ask a question on that last point. My understanding and impression is that the districts that are challenged by the cap are not evenly distributed across the state. Is there something that unites them? Or is it more one district here and another district there sort of a distribution?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's more one district here, another district there. I don't think there's any geographic region where all of those districts are. It depends really on the unique situation in each district as they, you know, as they get a new set of special ed students each year.
Okay. Thank you.
And the last bullet point here is that both the governor and the House would reduce the tuition rate paid by the resident district to the open enrolled district or the charter school. The House does more of that than the governor. The governor goes from 90 to 85 to 80. The House went from 90 to 80 to 70. So, again, both moving in the same direction but at different speeds in terms of trying to find the right balance there between how much the resident district should pay and how much the serving district should pay.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Questions from members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you. And this may have been discussed earlier, and I missed it, but just if there are the factor back on the slide that shows the cross-subsidy for the different types of schools, just wondering what the factors are that drive Minneapolis and St. Paul having so much higher costs versus variation among those different types. And again, my apologies if you did cover that, if you could just recap that if you did.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, I would say that the Minneapolis-St. Paul School District have a higher concentration of students with high needs that drives a lot of the cost. Certainly in the metropolitan area, we have salaries that are higher than they are in rural areas. So again, that drives the cross-subsidy because the cost of special education is primarily a cost for staffing. And so where the average salary schedules are higher in the metro than in the non-metro, you see higher cross subsidies. You're paying 30% of the cost of the teacher salary. But I would say primarily the reason between, let's say, Minneapolis and suburban districts would be primarily the high concentration of students with disabilities whose families choose to live there. There certainly is a correlation between poverty levels, disadvantage, and special education incidents. We know we have a higher concentration of poverty there. Also, I think Minneapolis-St. Paul have more open enrollment to charter schools, and in some cases the cost would be higher in the charter schools than it would be if the district served the students on their own. So contributing to that cross-subsidy is some of those higher tuition bills that they see.
Thank you.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Dr. Melcher, I think that last bullet point was the one I was going to ask about. It seems like the higher concentration of charter schools in the bill back might be driving some of those costs.
Yes.
Members, the Senate, I'm told, is reconvening at 3:50. Convening or reconvening?
Mr. Chair, we're reconvening at 3:30, but we should...
3:15.
Oh, yes. I made a mistake. Yes, we need to return.
We need to recess, yes. Dr. Melcher, don't go too far away.
I'll be around.
So, members, Senator Nelson and I have a suspicion that the two bodies may be leapfrogging each other today. Senator Nelson, do you know how long to anticipate the Senate to be in session?
I don't. It could be short. It could be long. We just don't know. How's that for an answer that covers everything?
Would it be helpful if maybe I asked Senator Wieger to get insight from a slightly different perspective as to how long the Senate might be in session today?
That's always helpful to have all sides of the equation.
So, but if I could introduce myself.
Oh, okay. Yes. When we recess, it will be to the call of the chair, and at this point, I cannot anticipate when that might be, as you heard the data. We'll try to give people hopefully up to a half an hour heads up before we would reconvene. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to introduce my intern to the committee, Curtis. I'm going to have to say goodbye to him today, but he's done an awesome job. And, Curtis, if you just want to stand up and tell us your last name and where you're from. Great. Thank you, Curtis.
All right. Glad you're with us today. With that, members of the committee stands in recess. With that, we reconvening the May 17th
E-12 Education Conference Committee. Dr. Melcher, if you are, there you are. Pardon. Unless there are member questions related to the special education cross-subsidy, my impression, Dr. Melcher, was that you had completed your presentation there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education, and we were about to go to slide 14, which was the first slide on English learners.
Right, and Dr. Melcher, if I may, we had, because what we're wanting to look at today, Senator Nelson, is the financial stability of opportunities for students in Minnesota. Obviously, we've both heard a great deal about the special education underfunding. But another area of underfunding where we task districts with providing a certain set of services to students who need and benefit from those services and who we want to be academically successful, we also don't fund it to the level that districts' costs are covered in providing those services. So there's it's highly similar to the special education underfunding that districts are struggling with. And I think the other thing that's maybe 20 years ago, don't hold me to this, English language learner funding, English language learning population would have been largely isolated in a few communities. And I think in that 20 years, we're finding immigrants and refugees from around the world in many places across the state. And it's not the geographically isolated districts or identified districts that you would expect. Many of our districts are challenged by this underfunding. Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, yes, the Senate is well aware of these dynamics, and, of course, one of the most challenging things is that it was our ELL population that saw the most significant decline in scores, which is worrisome, in academic achievement, that's worrisome, and this is really the fastest growing part of our population. And so clearly we look forward to hearing from Dr. Melcher, perhaps some things that we're not aware of already and perhaps some graphs that we haven't seen.
All right. Dr. Melcher, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will move then to the next slide. Oops, I'm sorry. Where am I at here? Here, slide 14. So this first slide is just showing you the trend since 1998 in the number of English language learners in the state of Minnesota. We've grown from about 26,900 to about 74,000 over that period of time, so quite a lot of increase. And what you'll see is there's kind of a kink in the line there where we had pretty rapid growth between 1998 and 2007. And since then, the growth has tapered off a bit but continues to increase each year. And anticipating Chair Nelson's question about how that relates to the overall enrollment, this is the percentages. We've grown from 3.2% English language learners up to 7.5% by 2007, and then some, you know, very gradual increase up to about 8.3% currently for English language learners across the state. As the Chair has noted, this does vary significantly among school districts, but we do have quite a sizable population of English language learners throughout the state. I thought it might be helpful just to share briefly with you a little bit of the history of the funding of this program. 1981 is when formula...
Dr. Melcher, if you'd pause for just a moment. Members, I believe before we recessed, you received a printout, the top dated 5/17/2019, the top title EL Aid Expenditures and Cross Subsidy, which identifies English language learning pupils across by district of all the districts in the state, and I presume charter schools and co-ops and all the like. So in terms of the geographic distribution of these learners, to your last point, Dr. Melcher. So thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just thought it might be helpful to review the history of this program. Before 1981, we had some pilot grants. In 1981, formula funding replaced those grants. Initially, ELL funding was similar to special education funding, where we reimbursed a percentage of salaries. Initially, it was 70% of the salary of one EL teacher for every 45 EL students, and that evolved over the years. 1997, we added concentration aid, so if you had a high concentration of EL students, you would receive some additional funding. At that time, it was set at $190 per student. Beginning in 1999, the overall EL formula was converted to a per-pupil rate. At that time, it was set at $584 per student. In 2003, the legislature made a change that beginning in fiscal 04, the formula was increased to $700. The concentration formula was increased to $250, but student eligibility was limited to 5 years. So that dramatically reduced the number of EL students that were eligible for funding, although districts continued to serve students who were had still English learning needs, but had already passed that five-year threshold. Then in 2013, there was a very slight rate adjustment from 700 to 704. And that was just because of a change in the pupil unit weighting system where we eliminated marginal cost pupil units where districts got additional pupil units if they had declining enrollment. So the 704 was really just to neutralize the effect of the pupil unit weighting change. So essentially the formula has been the same for the last 15 years in terms of it's not linked to the general ed formula like compensatory is as an example. So we've lost a lot of buying power in terms of the formula since we were at 700 in 2004 and we're still at essentially 700 today. So what has changed is that there's been a gradual increase in the number of years. In 2014, the legislature increased the eligibility limit to 6 years and then in 2015 to 7 years. So we still have a cap, but it's now it's 7 years. So how has that affected the overall funding level? And the next chart is going to show you that. What this shows is the inflation-adjusted EL aid per EL student. So this is not all students. This is just the English language learner students now. And so what that shows is there was a big drop in 2005 when the cutoff at 5 years took effect. And then after that, there was a gradual decline until 2013 because of the kind of the formula staying constant at 700 and kind of losing ground to inflation. And then the funding increased in 2015 because of the adding the sixth year onto the calculation. And there's been a little bit of increase since then. I believe that's probably because of some higher concentrations. More districts are getting that maximum concentration aid now, which the concentration aid is a sliding scale. It tops out at $250 per EL student if you have more than 11.5%. of your students, English language learners. So you get the 704 plus another 250 if you're a district that has more than 11.5%. What we've been seeing is, as a number of districts throughout the state have higher concentrations, they're getting more concentration aid because they're over that 11.5%. So if you would like to see how that affects us in terms of a cross-subsidy, if we compare the amount of funding under the EL formula with what districts report their spending in UFARS, and you know, as you know from looking at UFARS data, it's not always perfect, but it gives you a pretty good ballpark idea. The dark green here at the bottom of the chart is the EL aid. The cross-subsidy is the lighter color, and then the total cost is the top line there. These are total dollars, current dollars, not adjusted for inflation. So the bottom line here is we've gone from $87 million to $149 million over the last 10 years being spent. The aid has grown from $40 million to $58 million. The cross-subsidy has grown from $47 million to $91 million. During that point in time. So much smaller than the special ed cross-subsidy, was a little bit higher than $700 million, but still a significant number nonetheless. And then if you want to see how that breaks down by region of the state, we have these strata that we often use, still much higher in Minneapolis and St. Paul than the state average. $348 per student on the average is the cross-subsidy in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Suburban districts are in the 112 to 148 range if we look at inner or outer ring suburbs. Larger non-metro districts, 78 on the average. So it does vary, but This kind of masks some of the differences in greater Minnesota in terms of some districts have a very high cross-subsidy and others not, and that's where the computer run would be able to let you see what's the what the impact is in some individual school districts. And then just finally, I wanted to make a note that the House bill would change the EL formula from $704 to $740 beginning in fiscal year 2020.
Questions from members?
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Melcher.
Yes.
I was curious about the change in 2016, where we added an extra year of eligibility for our ELL kids. And I just wanted to know if have we seen any results that have correlated with that? As far as proficiency of those students who have had an extra year of ELL?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, that's a very good question. I don't know if we have anybody here from the department today that could speak to that. No, we don't. So I'm sure we do have information about the achievement levels of various groups. I'm afraid I'm just not prepared to
sure.
answer that one.
And if we could get that, I think that's sure. very important to mm-hmm. see how did that investment how did that help encourage or how did that correlate with student
sure.
growth?
Sure.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, since it just went up and the extra year was just added in 2017, would the data be pretty slim to see a difference in 2 years?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, I believe that is true. There's limited time for that impact to be seen there, but certainly we can look at the data and see if there's anything from the last year or two of test results.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
And so I'd like the data from the 2014 increase and then the 2017 increase, and it'd be really helpful to just get a view of how that impacted student achievement. Thank you.
Dr. Melcher, let me reframe this. Is it a matter of you'd indicated in your presentation that districts were providing these services beyond the five-year limit that existed previous to 14, I believe that was?
Mr. Chair, yes. The change, I believe, was took effect in fiscal year 15. It was 2014 okay. legislation yeah. took effect in fiscal 15. I believe most of these eligible students would have been served by districts.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been some cases where the district discontinued, but I think the districts have an obligation to continue providing the service if the students need the service. So we may not, that's a very good point, we may not have seen a change, a big change in who actually got served as a result of the. So it would have helped reduce the cross-subsidy, but not necessarily changed who received the services. So that might, upon reflection, might suggest that there might not have been a lot of change in the services. We could certainly look at the expenditure data a little closer. It's a pretty even line on the expenditures growing up gradually, and what you see is basically the aid portion going up and probably the cross subsidy going down slightly between 2013 and 2015 or so. So I think we can certainly want to look at that. It's always important to be looking at how our students are doing. But it may very well be that there wasn't a dramatic change in the service because of the change in which years the state was funding.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. But we should see how achievement correlates. And if the department has that information, it would also be very important and helpful to know and specifically pull out that subset of students who or in districts mm-hmm. that had not been serving kids in year 6 and 7, and what did those correlations look like after that after those extra years. So I think that's very important, and we should have 4 years of data, and so we'll look forward to looking at that and know there's some caveats that go with that.
We'll bring that thank to you. Our folks who work with the achievement data and see if we can get some good information.
Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, I'm sorry, I'm really, really showing my ignorance here. So I'm reflecting back on our school district, too, and what you're saying is districts are required to were required to serve students if they needed it. We just weren't paying them for it. So that's an unfunded mandate. So just because the money went in, the results might not change because districts were already doing the service without getting reimbursed. Is that accurate?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, I believe so. I'm not a program expert in the EL area, so I'm going off of kind of memory in terms of how that works. But I do know that districts have served students as long as they need the service. There is also a provision that if a student has tested as being proficient in English, that they then would not be served. So I think that's usually the determinant is if the test results or the teacher evaluations indicate that the student is now proficient in English, that's what drives the student leaving the program rather than the money ran out. Although I suppose there's a temptation there to say, well, the money's not there and it's creating a big hole in our budget. So you know, hopefully that's not affecting the district's decisions about students being served.
And Dr. Melcher, you're not the program expert in this area, as I understand. But my recollection of having been around for a number of these fights, the research shows that it takes 7 years of intervention to get a student up to academic proficiency in English. And that was part of the problem with initial drop to 5 years and then the increase to 6 years, was it didn't match up with what we know works for students.
That's consistent with what I've heard over the years as well.
All right.
Chair. Yes.
All right. Other questions from members? Senator Nelson.
Just a quick question, maybe not so much for Dr. Melcher, but I just was trying to. What was the price tag on the ELL funding in the House bill? I don't have that right in front of me here. And also the special ed piece that we had talked about earlier.
Ms. Adrians, can you be the authoritative voice on that, please?
I need to be careful with these microphones. thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. The House bill funds the change in the English learner revenue, and the cost in the first biennium is just over $4.4 million, and in the TALES, it's $4.7 million. And then... chairs for the special ed piece. Madam Chair, were you asking for the funding increase in reform for all of the pieces that the House bill does? It's almost $118 million for the 2021 biennium. And then in the TALES, it's $173
million. Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Okay. With that, and the murkiness of both bodies' paths tonight, we will stand in recess to the call of the chair. We will give people hopefully up to an hour's heads up so that folks who wish can go watch Almanac at their favorite location. Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, I saw that there was a posting on Twitter that the traditional panel will not be on tonight.
I take that as a good sign.
There are rumors amongst us that the panel previously announced may not be there, but may be sending. Have you gotten a call from the majority leader asking you to step in for him?
I'm here.
You'll be here. Senator Nelson, are you subbing in on Almanac tonight?
I'm not saying where I'm going.
Okay. We'll leave just a little mystery, overlaying the murkiness.
Sounds like a novel.
I think I can make the same commitment tonight that we will not call people back after 9 p.m. So an hour's heads up. You've got a pretty narrow window. An hour's heads up if we're going to reconvene. If you don't hear from us by 9, put your feet up and enjoy the rest of the evening. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We stand in recess to the call of the chair.